There's a story that in New Orleans in 1852, two men were set to be hanged for murder. Jean Adam and Antony Delisle had been convicted of the murder of a young woman named Mary, who had been a slave of one of the city's prominent families. The death had occurred as the result of a botched burglary. Allegedly, the unfortunate Mary had discovered Adam and Delisle breaking into her master's home, and the men wasted no time killing the witness. In court, multiple witnesses testified that they had heard the two men planning the burglary and even discussing their willingness to kill any slaves who might discover them. While justice had been swift in condemning the two men to death, Adam and Delisle consistently maintained that they were innocent. They argued that they had been hapless scapegoats who had been framed for someone else's crime, but the pleas fell on deaf ears. Well, mostly. On July 11th, 1852, the two men were dragged before a huge crowd to be publicly executed. In some tellings, the crowd numbered over 6,000. As they were led to the gallows, both men screamed of their innocence, but the die was cast. Black hoods were placed over their heads, and a noose was fixed over each of their necks. But just then, the crowd noticed something strange. The previously sunny day suddenly clouded over, and a torrential rain started to fall. A woman in the crowd was heard yelling, "My God, it's like the crucifixion!" Undaunted, the hangman continued with the execution and released the trapdoor that should have sent the men to their deaths. But at exactly the moment that the trap was sprung, a massive thunderclap rent the air and lightning crashed all around. The nooses slipped from the men's necks and the prisoners fell to the ground with a dramatic crash. The fall had severely injured both men, but they were both still alive, apparently saved by some form of divine intervention. However, Louisiana law still demanded justice, so the two men were revived, patched up so as to be considered healthy enough for a hanging, I know, weird, and were marched up the gallows for a second time. This time, the hanging was successful, but it was gruesome. The hanging caused the men's recently sustained wounds to open up and bleed. The blood mixed with the rain and turned the men's white shirts an intense crimson color. The crowd, who, to be clear, had come to see two men die, had gotten much more than they bargained for. The display was so vulgar that it actually may have turned public opinion in Louisiana against the death penalty, or at least against public executions. The New Orleans paper, the Daily Picayune, would write this the next day, quote, "The current opinion is setting directly against these kinds of displays. We trust that the law will soon be changed, and if capital punishment must still be retained in our codes, that the execution be directed to take place in private without parade or ostentation." End quote. Sure enough, 2 years later, the Louisiana legislature banned public executions in New Orleans, with the noted exception being the execution of slaves. Nevertheless, the hanging of Adam and Delisle was often cited as the tipping point that changed the law. But it's been claimed that the people of New Orleans remembered something else from that day. Once the two men died, like clockwork, the rain cleared and the sun shone again. Then, pacing away from the crowd, many spotted a tall, strikingly beautiful woman wearing a colorful head wrap known as a tignon that identified her as a free woman of color. Many started to whisper, "There goes Marie Laveau, queen of the voodoos." It had been rumored that Madame Laveau had been visiting the prisoners in jail for over a week, There she had been ministering to them, praying with them, and concocting a series of voodoo charms. For their last meal, the men had apparently dined on gumbo prepared by Marie Laveau herself. For many in the crowd, it was clear that the day's events had been affected by the great magic of the Voodoo Queen. The sudden storm, the thunder and lightning, the fact that both nooses failed. This had all been conjured by the great Marie Laveau. Even the ultimate outcome, the banning of public executions, even that had been part of the wise woman's plan. Or at least, so went the whispers. The story is incredible, unbelievable, and a perfect encapsulation of much of the lore that surrounds Marie Laveau. Laveau was born and raised in New Orleans and called the city home until her death in 1881. Over the course of her life, she earned a reputation as a powerful conjurer, a healer, and a friend to the sick and condemned. She was the high priestess of a religion known as voodoo, or more accurately, she was remembered as the most important practitioner of New Orleans-style voodoo in the 19th century. In a city whose history is filled with colorful characters and visionary artists, she still manages to stand out as one of the most memorable people to ever call the Crescent City home. And yet, most of what is popularly repeated about the great Marie Laveau is completely untrue. Take the story of the execution. In many ways, this is an archetypal Marie Laveau legend. It includes all the key elements that turn up in countless other stories about the voodoo priestess. First, there's her ministry to the condemned, or society's undesirables. There are charms, even a magic gumbo. There's a shocking demonstration of power, in this case, power over nature itself. Then there's often an enigmatic resolution. It can be unclear if Laveau's magic was meant for good or evil, and it's only later revealed that a higher justice has been served. This story is also notable because it's based on a real historical event. The botched hanging of Adam and Delisle really did happen. It really was gruesome, and the papers really did call for an end to public executions after the fact. But other details have clearly been invented. The sunny day suddenly turning cloudy and the perfectly timed thunderclap are not mentioned anywhere in the contemporary reports of the event. And that seems like a hell of a thing to leave out. In fact, Marie Laveau isn't mentioned in any of the primary sources associated with this event. The story of Laveau at the gallows only seems to appear in print for the first time in the 1940s, 90 years after the fact. And as any longtime listener of Our Fake History can tell you, the later a story appears in the historical record after it's said to have taken place, the more likely it is to be a historical myth. This story first appears in the work of the celebrated New Orleans writer Robert Talent, whose books Voodoo in New Orleans and The Voodoo Queen of New Orleans did much to shape the modern myth of Marie Laveau. You see, while Marie Laveau clearly left an impression on the people of New Orleans, precious few things were written about her during her lifetime. In fact, most of what we know about Marie Laveau comes from interviews that were conducted with elderly New Orleanians in the 1930s, some 50 years after she died. By that time, a healthy amount of folklore had grown up around the famous priestess. From there, authors and amateur storytellers started spinning more and more elaborate tales of Marie Laveau. Even today, you can find people in New Orleans who will tell you that her ghost still walks the city and commands enormous power. As you can imagine, trying to determine what we should believe about a woman like Marie Laveau presents some real challenges. She was involved in a religion that was secretive, misunderstood, and often slandered. By the time anyone thought to chronicle her life, she was already a folk hero, or, according to some, a villain. On top of that, she was a free woman of color who lived in Louisiana at a time when the politics of race could not have been more complex. Throw in a few bowls of magic gumbo, and any investigator looking for quote-unquote truth can very quickly find himself chasing ghosts. Can we separate the fact from the fiction when it comes to New Orleans' greatest voodoo queen? Let's find out today on Our Fake History. Episode number 118, Who Was the Voodoo Queen of New Orleans, Part 1. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the podcast that explores historical myths and tries to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week, we are heading to 19th century New Orleans to explore the life and legend of Voodoo Queen Marie Laveau. Now, before we get started today, just wanted to remind everyone that Dirty Church, the band that brings us the theme song for this show, still has their new EP for sale at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. If you want to hear a track from that new EP, then stick around to the very end of the show where I will be playing a brand new song from that band. So stick around right to the end. Now, as I've mentioned before on this show, New Orleans may be one of my favorite cities in the world. It's easily in my top five. It's got absolutely everything I love. A rich and weird history, tons of local legends, an amazing music scene, and awesome food. Now, to be fair, I've only ever experienced New Orleans as a tourist, but that experience of bar hopping down Frenchman Street, catching a micless set of modal jazz at the Spotted Cat, then finding your way to a brass funk dance party with a hip-hop MC at the Blue Nile, for me, that is one version of heaven. Even in 2020, New Orleans remains a completely unique North American city. One of the things that makes New Orleans so unique is the history of voodoo in the city. Now, unfortunately, voodoo often gets presented as a hokey caricature of what is for many a serious religion. The word voodoo conjures up images of top hat-wearing men in skull makeup, wearing necklaces made of bones and brandishing little dolls stuck through with pins. This is the Halloween dress-up version of voodoo that unfortunately gets hawked to tourists in cheap gift shops. Interestingly, voodoo's most recognizable emblem, the voodoo doll, was actually used extremely rarely in both traditional Haitian and Louisiana voodoo. Torturing someone in effigy form is actually far more common in European magical traditions. The voodoo doll seems to have entered popular legend sometime after 1915, when American Marines occupied Haiti to prop up a government friendly to American business interests. The occupation lasted into the 1930s. And in that time, sensational tales of voodoo written by Marines, or inspired by the experiences of Marines, started to become popular in the U.S. The first known mention of a voodoo doll comes from John Huston Craig's 1933 memoir, Black Baghdad, The Arabian Nights Adventures of a Marine Captain in Haiti. Craig was an American Marine with a deeply racist worldview. He had nothing but contempt for Haitian people. As such, his presentation of voodoo tends to focus on the most salacious and titillating elements. Most experts think his memoir is deeply unreliable, at least when it comes to voodoo. Now, I bring up Craig's book because it's indicative of a whole body of literature that came out in the 20s and 30s that shaped the popular conception, or rather misconception, of voodoo in the United States. It was in this period that images of spooky witch doctors and zombies started to become a more recognizable part of pop culture. By the way, if you didn't know, zombies were not always the walking dead. They were originally thought to be mind-controlled people who had been placed under a voodoo curse. All of this is to say that the popular representations of voodoo always presented it as an exotic, dark, and evil form of magic. Now, while the rest of America really became acquainted with voodoo in the early 20th century, thanks to the sensational accounts of American Marines in Haiti, in Louisiana, it was a completely different story. There, voodoo had been part of the culture for well over a century. While similar to its Haitian counterpart, Louisiana voodoo was distinct in a number of key ways that I promise we will unpack in detail in this series. The point is, in Louisiana, voodoo was nothing new. And while the practice was most often associated with the black and mixed race people of the state, as we'll see, many white folks from Louisiana were also clearly participating in voodoo rituals. The white authorities in New Orleans seemed to be of two minds when it came to voodoo. During some periods, it was persecuted. Meetings were busted up by the police, and the practice was outlawed. At other times, it was tolerated, even celebrated as something that made the city special. This inconsistent love-hate relationship with voodoo also seems to have extended to the city's most famous practitioner of the religion, Marie Laveau. As I mentioned before, almost nothing was written about Marie Laveau during her lifetime, only a handful of brief mentions in some of the local papers. But when Marie Laveau died in 1881, every major New Orleans paper carried a long obituary. Her passing was even considered national news, as even the New York Times published an obit. Clearly, someone quite important to the life of New Orleans had just passed. But the exact reasons why she was important varied greatly depending on which newspaper's obituary you read. Now, I want to read to you from a few of these obituaries. But before I do, I think I need to take a minute and address an issue that's going to pop up a few times in this series. Many of the primary sources from this period contain racist language. I mean, we're dealing with the American South in the 1800s here. Now, I know for many of our listeners, hearing a white guy say these hurtful terms out loud can be painful and upsetting. Out of consideration for that, I thought about completely avoiding the racial slurs in these texts altogether. But that didn't seem right, as it may have whitewashed the racist reality of the past. When quoting from these sources, I think it's important that we confront the explicit racism present within them. Now, thankfully, the N-word has not come up in any of the quotes I want to use for this series. So, rest assured, you won't be hearing that word come out of my mouth. But other derogatory terms for black people and people of color in general do pop up. I promise to only use these terms in the context of quotes or in the discussion of quotes. And I promise not to use these terms excessively or exploitatively. I really want this series to be an honest look at the contributions of Black and mixed-race people to the culture of the American South and North America in general. My goal is to educate and entertain and hopefully not hurt anyone along the way. So, we'll see how I do. Okay, back to those obituaries. So as I was saying, depending on which paper you read, you got a very different impression of who Marie Laveau was. By far the most glowing obituary came from the Daily Picayune, which portrayed her as a devout Catholic, a nurse to the sick, a friend to the poor, and a pillar of the community. Interestingly, the Picayune obit never once used the word voodoo. If your only information about Marie Laveau came from that report, you might never assume that she was one of the city's most famous voodoo priestesses. The Picayune wrote, quote, "Beside being very beautiful, Marie was also very wise. She was skillful in the practice of medicine and was acquainted with the valuable healing qualities of indigenous herbs. She was very successful as a nurse, wonderful stories being told of her exploits at the sickbed. In the yellow fever and cholera epidemics, she was always called upon to nurse the sick and always responded promptly. Her skill and knowledge earned her the friendship and approbation of those sufficiently cultivated, but the ignorant attributed her success to unnatural means and held her in constant dread." End quote. So, according to the Picayune, Marie Laveau was a great healer and an herbalist. It was only the ignorant who ascribed her ability to what they called, quote-unquote, unnatural means. The article concludes, quote, "All in all, Marie Laveau was a most wonderful woman. Doing good for the sake of doing good, she obtained no reward. Oftentimes meeting with prejudice and loathing, she was nevertheless contented and did not lag in her work. She always had the cause of the people at heart and was with them in all things. Marie Laveau's name will not be forgotten in New Orleans." End quote. On that last count, they were very correct. Now, it's striking when you contrast that loving tribute to Laveau with the much more derisive and casually racist obituary that appeared in the New Orleans Democrat the same day. Here's what the Democrat had to say. And heads up, here's some of that racist language I was talking about. Quote, "Marie Laveau, as is well known by the old residents of the city, was the queen of the voodoos, that curious sect of superstitious darkies that combined the hard traditions of African legend with the fetish worship of our Creole Negroes." End quote. Another piece in the Democrat went so far as to say, quote, "She was, up to an advanced age, the prime mover and the soul of the indecent orgies of the ignoble voodoos, and to her influence may be attributed the fall of many virtuous women." End quote. For the Democrat, a decidedly more conservative paper, Marie Laveau was clearly a villainous figure. But even in this largely negative obituary, the last line really sums up white Louisiana's simultaneous fear of and fascination with voodoo. The Democrat concluded, quote, "Much evil dies with her, but should we not add a little poetry?" End quote. It's interesting because even this article, which is the most negative assessment of Marie Laveau, is still punctuated with a little wink at the end, as if to say, "Nah, we'll miss her." So, right off the bat, the first time we get anything of substance written about Marie Laveau in the historical record, there are wildly different assessments of who she was and why she mattered. So, let's take a closer look at the world that Marie Laveau was born into and see if we can get a better sense of who she really was. Thank you. When it comes to the life of Marie Laveau, historians have two very different types of sources to go from. First, there are the scraps that appear in the archive. These are marriage certificates, birth notices, bills of sale for slaves, and a handful of mentions in the local papers. These documents can help give the outline of a life, but they don't really provide much color. For that, you have to go to the oral histories collected about Marie Laveau. In the 1930s, as part of FDR's New Deal, in an attempt to put journalists and writers to work, thousands were employed by the Works Project Administration. In Louisiana, this took the form of something called the Louisiana Writers Project. One of their initiatives was to collect and preserve the oral history and folklore of the state. In that time, dozens of mostly Black New Orleanians were interviewed about their recollections of New Orleans during their youth. They were specifically asked about the city's unique traditions around Mardi Gras and St. John's Eve, and they were all asked about Marie Laveau. While these interviews are certainly better than the unsourced legends about Marie Laveau, they're far from perfect. Most of the interviewees were elderly when they were interviewed, and their memories could be, you know, unreliable. On top of that, many of them had been children when Marie Laveau was still alive. So, while the Louisiana Writers Project interviews certainly help us fill in some blanks, they're not without their own issues. As a result, most of what we get when it comes to Marie Laveau are good guesses. So, just a heads up, this topic is murkier than most. But let's start with what we know for sure. Marie Laveau was born in New Orleans on July 10th, 1801. Now, right off the bat, we have some controversy because her birth year is often recorded as 1794. But all of the experts agree that that date is incorrect, and documents found at the St. Louis Cathedral in New Orleans confirm that she was born in 1801. Now, legend has it that Marie Laveau's father was a rich white plantation owner. The Picayune obituary actually printed that story as a fact, writing, quote, "Her father was a rich planter who was prominent in all public affairs and served in the legislature of this state," end quote. In this version of the story, her mother was a free woman of color with whom this unnamed planter had an illicit affair. But this has since been proven to be completely untrue. Records show that Marie's father was actually a wealthy free man of color named Charles Laveau, and her mother was a certain Marguerite Henry. Now, some of the confusion about Marie's father being an important white politician may have come from the fact that her paternal grandfather, named Charles Laveau Trudeau, had been the surveyor general for Louisiana during its time as a Spanish colony. He even served as acting mayor of New Orleans for part of a year. Marie Laveau's father was most likely that man's illegitimate mixed-race son. Now, both of her parents were free people of color, which in New Orleans in the early 19th century had a very specific meaning. The free people of color were a group of people with mixed racial heritage who developed a place in Louisianan society that was distinct from both enslaved people of African descent and white people of European descent. This group emerged during the period when Louisiana was a French colony. Louisiana, named for the French king Louis XIV, was once a massive territory that was part of what was known as New France, that is, France's colonial holdings in North America that it started gobbling up in the mid-16th century. In 1722, Louisiana was administratively split from French Canada, But it was still massive, running from the Great Lakes in the north all the way south to New Orleans, encompassing huge swaths of territory on either side of the Mississippi River. The French introduced slavery to the region in 1719, when the first two slave ships arrived in New Orleans from Africa. In this early period, it was very common for male French colonists to have relationships with both African and indigenous women. The nature of these relationships varied hugely from couple to couple. In some cases, these relationships were basically consensual marriages. In other cases, women were forced into being concubines, and as such, it's probably best characterized as rape. The children of these unions were often freed from slavery by their white fathers. As time progressed, there were enough free people of mixed heritage that they started existing as their own identifiable class in society. Many free people coupled up with other free people of color, which meant that their children were born free. Now, this was particularly notable in a society where dark skin usually meant you were a slave. In New Orleans, there was a sizable part of the population that was dark-skinned, but had never been slaves, and as such, they did not identify as black. The free people of color also became associated with the Creole community. Creole was a name given to French people who had been born in the colony. That differentiated them from French folks born in Europe. This Creole community eventually developed their own separate culture and even separate language from the continental French. The French from Europe looked down on this colonial Creole population, an attitude that was later adopted by the Anglo-Americans when they gained control of Louisiana. But it's important to understand that in this period there were both white and colored Creole communities. In this period, colored being an imprecise term that usually meant mixed race. Now, if you ever need to convince someone that race has little to do with biology and is actually an idea that was constructed historically, just point them to the history of Louisiana. People sometimes have a hard time with the idea that racial categories have been made up, because ideas of race have been with us for so long, they can seem like facts. Differences in appearance seem to reinforce these ideas. I mean, how can you say there's no such thing as race when there are clearly differences in skin color? But here's the thing. Race is not skin tone. Let's go back to the history of Louisiana for a great example. There were many free people of color who were described as having light skin and entirely European features, but they were known to have one dark-skinned African grandparent. Those people were not considered white. They were known as quadroons, i.e. one quarter black. How's that for a ridiculously outdated racial term? Quadroons. There were even people in Louisiana society that were known as octoroons. That is, you have one great-grandparent who was African. Now, the fact that no one identifies as octoroon anymore is proof enough that racial categories have a way of appearing and disappearing throughout history. But even more strikingly, if you lived during Louisiana's colonial period, your racial category may have changed up to three times depending on who controlled the colony. If you were someone with mixed heritage, your legal racial identity may have been one thing under the French. Then when the Spanish took over in 1763, you may have been slotted into a completely different racial category, as the Spanish had their own arbitrarily constructed systems of dividing people up. Then, for a hot minute, Napoleon got Louisiana back for the French, before ultimately selling it to the United States in 1803. The Anglo-American powers were even less comfortable with racial mixing than their French and Spanish predecessors, and as such, the racial categories changed again. Even the term colored would come to have new meanings by the time we get to the Jim Crow era. However arbitrary these racial categories were, they still ended up being ideas around which people constructed their identities and communities. The free people of color in New Orleans had a culture and an ethnic identity that was all their own. Now, you might be wondering why I'm lingering so long on this discussion of race. Well, it matters when you're trying to understand not only the life of Marie Laveau, but the history of voodoo in the city of New Orleans in general. By the time Louisiana became an American state, the free people of color had become an industrious part of New Orleans society. Many free people of color were successful business owners, and some were quite wealthy. What we know today as the French Quarter was basically built by free people of color. That was where many of their successful businesses were run. Now, one way that some free women of color gained both wealth and influence in New Orleans society was through a complex arrangement known as placage. This was where free women of color became the well-kept mistresses of wealthy white men. I'll allow historian Carolyn Merrill Long to explain this in more detail. Quote, "In contrast to the exploitative sexual relationships between masters and slave women, white men and free women of color formed liaisons that, although unlawful, often resembled true marriages. In common parlance, the practice was known as placage, from the French word placer, or to place, in this case, to place under a man's protection. The woman was called a placer. In contravention of laws forbidding whites to make donations to persons of color, the man would provide a small cottage and would support the placer and her children for life, even if he also established a white family." End quote. So, some of these so-called placés eventually became quite wealthy and well-dressed, so much so that during the Spanish period, the uneasy authorities ended up passing sumptuary laws. Those are laws that regulate what you can wear. In this case, what free people of color could wear. Free women of color were required by law to wear a head wrap known as a tignon in public to mark them as not white. And man, you know that racial categories are fragile when to police them, you need to start issuing headgear. But making lemonade out of these racist lemons, free people of color eventually made these tignons into vibrant fashion statements. Marie Laveau is usually described as wearing a colorful tignon with 7 points, 7 being a significant number in Louisiana voodoo. So even after the end of the Spanish period, when the sumptuary laws were dropped, many women of color still chose to wear the tignon. At the time of Marie Laveau's birth, right when Louisiana was about to be handed over to the United States, the community of free colored people was flourishing, a situation that the new Anglo-American leadership found problematic. Carolyn Merrill Long explains, quote, "Most of the free colored people owned their homes and earned modest livings. The wealthier Creoles of color were well-educated and successful, controlling extensive real estate in New Orleans or plantations in the countryside. An unusually high percentage of free colored business people and real estate owners were women. None of this could be swallowed by the Anglo-Americans, who were accustomed to the concept of slavery as a permanent condition appropriate to people of an inferior race, and who considered free people of African descent an anomaly that threatened the stability of society, end quote. So, despite the financial success of the Free People of Color, the group was entirely shut out of political power in what was a white-run slave state. The Voodoo religion, on the other hand, was completely run by African-born people and free people of color, like Marie Laveau. On top of that, the religion was largely female-run, with women often in leadership positions. There were only a few ways a woman of color could have power in antebellum Louisiana, and voodoo was one of them. And as we'll see, the anxieties about voodoo often had little to do with a fear of evil magic. No, what really concerned the authorities was that voodoo rituals had a way of bringing black, mixed, and white people together. But now that I've spent some time setting up the complex racial character of Laveau's community, I think it's time that we look more closely at her actual life. So, let's take a look. The first time Marie Laveau appears unambiguously in the archival record is in August of 1819, when she was first married. She was married in New Orleans' St. Louis Cathedral by a famous local priest known as Père Antoine. Her husband was a man named Jacques Perry, a free man of color who had fled to New Orleans from Haiti, formerly Saint-Domingue, after the outbreak of the revolution on that island. Baptismal records also show that the couple had two daughters. But then, only a few years after they were married, Jacques Perry disappeared. We have absolutely no idea what happened to him. He's just gone. All we know is that eventually he was presumed dead, and Marie Laveau started referring to herself as the Widow Perry. Now, when you have a hole in the story that big, it's no wonder that fiction writers have had a field day filling it up. In Robert Tallent's novel, Voodoo Queen of New Orleans, Tallent imagines that Jacques Perry left Marie Laveau because she had thrown herself too deeply into voodoo. Perry then dies at sea while traveling between New Orleans and France. In Francine Prose's Marie Laveau, the novelist imagines that Jacques Perry was possessed on the wedding night by the voodoo spirit of love and femininity. This spirit then steals Jacques away from Marie and takes him as her own lover. In Voodoo Dreams, author Jules Parker Rhodes has Jacques Perry turned into a zombie by the African conjurer Dr. John, and more on him in just a moment. Now, I bring up these literary examples partially because, you know, they're fun, but also to show how the Marie Laveau legend has developed. Even though those books were all works of fiction, they've shaped the way people perceive Marie Laveau. Wherever there's a gap in the historical record, writers have been quick to fill it with stories of zombies and voodoo spirits. Anyway, the tradition is that after the disappearance of Jacques Perry, Marie Laveau really threw herself into the practice of voodoo. Some sources even provide the year 1826 as the official start of Laveau's career as a voodoo priestess. But as Carolyn Merrill Long has pointed out, there's no evidence that supports that date having any significance in the life of Marie Laveau. Other experts like Denise Alvarado have explained that it seems highly unlikely that Laveau just stumbled into voodoo in her mid-20s. Alvarado thinks that it's most likely that voodoo was in Marie Laveau's family and that she may have been taught the practice by her mother or grandmother, which, you know, is a reasonable guess, but yet again, it's still just a guess. You often read that Marie Laveau was the protege of a voodoo master known as Dr. John, the conjurer I mentioned earlier. Dr. John, aka Jean Montanet, was a real contemporary of Marie Laveau who lived in New Orleans at the same time. He was a former slave from Senegal who claimed to have been a prince in his home country. He earned a reputation as one of New Orleans' most powerful voodoo priests. According to legend, his specialty was dealing with a strange poltergeist phenomenon where stones fell like rain inside people's houses. Pay Dr. John the right amount of money, and your weird stone rain would stop. Cross Dr. John, and the stones might just start falling again. And yes, for the music fans in the crowd, this is the figure that inspired New Orleans musician Mac Rebinac's stage name. You might know Dr. John the Night Tripper. The story is that the original Dr. John recognized the great power that clearly emanated from the young Marie Laveau as soon as he met her. So he took her under his wing and taught her the arts of voodoo. But once again, there seems to be little or no historical basis for this story. The two seem to have little connection with each other. While there are a handful of descriptions of Marie Laveau conducting voodoo ceremonies, never is Dr. John mentioned. According to the people interviewed by the Louisiana Writers Project, Marie Laveau and Dr. John weren't even in the same league. Marie Laveau was remembered as a respected and powerful woman who was the uncontested head of the voodoo religion. The recollections of Dr. John were that he was a far less important figure. Some informants even believed that Dr. John was a charlatan who faked his voodoo miracles and hustled people for money. For many of these informants, Marie Laveau had been the real deal, whereas Dr. John was just another local rascal. What is clear is that after the disappearance of Jacques Perry, Marie Laveau, or the Widow Perry, started gaining a reputation as a powerful woman. Tradition has it that she started to work as a hairdresser, catering to women at all levels of New Orleans society. She did the hair of wealthy white women and also established relationships with their slaves and household servants. It's been guessed that Laveau cultivated a massive network of informants from among the city's slaves. The slaves would pass on household secrets and other important information to Marie Laveau. Now, once again, we don't really have good, solid proof of this, but it's been speculated that this network of informants helped Marie Laveau appear clairvoyant. If you came to visit her looking for advice or maybe a helpful charm, she seemed to know your problems even before you told her. Eventually, her reputation grew to the point that many of New Orleans' well-to-do citizens started seeking her out for advice and perhaps a little magical intervention. Two men interviewed by the Louisiana Writers Project, Joseph Alford and James Santana, would remember this about Marie Laveau. Quote, "She worked mostly for white people, and she made piles of money. Sometimes she made up to $1,000, but $500, $200, and $100 were her popular prices. Clients paid her plenty to win cases in the courts. There were always a line of carriages in front of her house, and the white ladies who entered were heavily veiled. They did not hesitate to consult Marie Laveau, who gave them powders to use on their husbands and bones to put in their pockets," end quote. So, if we can believe the recollections of these two gentlemen, voodoo worship was not exclusive to black and mixed-race people in New Orleans. According to them, Marie Laveau catered almost exclusively to white people. This interview also underscored the importance of her home on St. Ann Street. And indeed, the Laveau Cottage would become one of the most important centers of voodoo worship in New Orleans. Now, of course, there's a story about how Marie Laveau came to own the St. Ann Street Cottage. The story goes that a wealthy man came to Marie Laveau desperate because his son was on trial for rape. A guilty verdict seemed inevitable. Marie Laveau said she could help, but it would cost the man. He agreed to whatever price she wanted, so long as his son walked free. So we're told that Marie Laveau went to St. Louis Cathedral, where she prayed before the altar. As she prayed, she placed 3 hot guinea peppers in her mouth. When she finished her prayers, she then snuck over to the nearby courthouse. She then took the guinea peppers out of her mouth and placed them under the judge's bench. The next day, Marie Laveau sat in the courtroom and watched the verdict. Sure enough, the judge amazingly delivered a not guilty verdict. The wealthy patron lived up to his side of the bargain and handed Marie Laveau the deed to the cottage on St. Ann Street. It's a weird story that both demonstrates the power of Marie Laveau while also being fraught with moral issues. There's nothing particularly noble about helping a rapist escape justice. Now, interestingly, there's one version of this story that ends with the young man and the victim reconciling and getting married thanks to the magical intervention of Marie Laveau and a well-placed gris-gris bag. That is a traditional voodoo charm that contains ingredients like lizard eggs, feathers, and donkey hair, all tied together in a small bag. So, I guess that story has more of a happy ending? I mean, by 19th century standards, it would be considered a happy ending because, you know, the marriage would be seen as making the girl a quote-unquote honest woman. Like most Marie Laveau stories, it would have been understood that a higher justice had been served in the end. But, I mean, these days, hearing the story of a woman being magicked into marrying her abuser, that doesn't really sit so well. Well, thankfully, this probably never happened. We know from city records that the St. Ann Street Cottage had actually been in Marie Laveau's family for a few generations. Marie Laveau's maternal grandmother had been a slave who managed to purchase her freedom during the Spanish colonial period. The Spanish allowed slaves to buy their freedom if their masters consented. And indeed, Marie Laveau's grandmother did just that for the price of 600 pesos. The American regime notably ended that practice. But Marie Laveau's grandmother worked for her freedom, and upon her emancipation, managed to make enough money to buy the small cottage on St. Ann Street. So, Marie Laveau seems to have inherited that house from her grandmother. And honestly, I like that story better. I mean, it has a lot less cool magic in it, but it seems better that the cottage is a symbol of the emancipation from slavery than, you know, helping a rich guy get away with rape. Still, the St. Ann Street home would become famous in New Orleans. Once Marie Laveau established herself as both a confidant to the wealthy and powerful and a friend to the poor and sick, it wouldn't be long before people started calling her queen. Okay, that's all for this week. Join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will conclude our look at Marie Laveau. Before we go this week, I need to give a very special shout out to the following people. Big ups to Heinrich Forsberg, to I hope I got that right. I feel like someone from Sweden put me up to that one. I'm not sure if I got all those umlauts correct there. And I'm not even really sure what the circle on top of a letter is really supposed to be. I honestly Googled it, and that's the best you get. All right, a big ups to Chad Nui, to Charles Holgate, to Alex Sitar, to Jack Dixon, to Mitch Bowman, to Jason Zittle, to Josh Reeves, to Thunderbird and the Bam Bam Twins. Oh, you guys rule. To Benjamin Defoe, to Amy Sophie, to F. Norman Pig from Shuswap Lake, BC, to Gretchen Srigley, to Madeline Hempstead, to Kate Justin Taylor, and to Theo Korchev. All of you have pledged $5 or more every month on Patreon. So you know what that means? You are all beautiful human beings. It's the best time to become a patron if you've been thinking about it. There are so many extras now, including that 3-hour Goliath extra episode I just put out on the life of Nikola Tesla. So if you want to become a patron, go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory and look at the level of support that you think will work for you. Before we go this week, I just want to remind everyone that if you ever want to get in touch with me, you can always send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. You can hit me up on Facebook at facebook.com/ourfakehistory, or you can tweet at me on Twitter at ourfakehistory. As always, the theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. And as I've been saying, Dirty Church has brand new music for sale at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com, or check them out at dirtychurchmusic.com. The new EP is called The Last Supper EP, and the song I'm going to take us out with today is called Heart Attack. All the other music you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.